Hello and welcome to today's episode of Hard Truths, the Gen Squeeze podcast that shines a light on Canada's broken generational system and how we can fix it together. I'm Paul Kershaw, founder of Gen Squeeze, and our hard truth today is that too many federal and provincial politicians are reluctant to champion the cause of generational fairness. This is partly because they don't always often recognize that our intergenerational system is broken, and so Gen Squeeze has more work to do on that front. But we definitely notice that it's increasingly common, and it's a good thing that, you know, politicians will state with pride that they're proponents for gender equality, racial equality, truth and reconciliation, equality for the queer community, and thanks goodness, because those are important movements. But the reality is also that we're less likely to see parliamentarians stand on guard specifically for generational fairness. So listeners of our podcast will know that we're on a quest to fix this problem, and we're doing so by having launched our pledge campaign. We're asking federal and provincial parliamentarians to specifically pledge on their social media channels to be hashtag Gen Fairness Champions. And as a result, I am very excited today to welcome one of our first pledge takers, MP Elizabeth May. And for many Canadians, MP May will be the face of green politics in our country. She has served as Green Party of Canada leader between 2006 and 2019. She's been the MP for the Saanich and Gulf Islands in British Columbia since 2011. Listeners will know that I'm a big fan of nonpartisanship, so I love the fact that Elizabeth May's fellow MPs, almost entirely from other parties, named her Parliamentarian of the Year in 2012, Hardest Working MP in 2013, Best Orator, ooh, that makes me nervous, in 2014, and Most Knowledgeable in 2020. And if that wasn't enough, presently MP May is running with colleague Jonathan Pettenome to be co-leaders of the Green Party of Canada, and that leadership race is going to come to a head later this month. And people will know that Gen Squeeze is not. We are not in the partisan business of endorsing politicians or parties, but we are in the game of evaluating the party platforms that they design. So to provide some context for today's dialogue with Elizabeth May, here's what I can tell listeners. In both the 2015 and the 2019 federal elections, when MP May was Green Party leader, our analysis, led from the Gen Squeeze lab at the University of BC, revealed that her party's platform was consistently at the front or near the front of party promises when it comes to making Canada work for all generations. And it wasn't just for climate change. It wasn't just for climate policy. It was also for policy related to childcare, parental leave, and work-life balance, housing, and more generally how to budget fairly for young and old alike so that in our country we invest in well-being for Canadians and not just treating our illness after we fall sick or addressing the fallout from crises that we could have actually prevented. So to be clear, being near or at the front of all federal parties doesn't mean Gen Squeeze didn't have some constructive feedback for the Green Party platform. And I had some fun earlier today reviewing our 2019 analysis of the party platforms. And I'm going to try to weave some of that into the conversation with MP May today. But what's really important for today's conversation is that when Gen Squeeze set out to invite politicians to take our pledge campaign, to pledge to be generational fairness champions, I knew we could count on Elizabeth May being among the very first. She did. And Elizabeth, I want you to know that many Canadians in our Gen Squeeze community are most appreciative. So thank you. And welcome to our Hard Truths podcast today.
Thank you, Paul. That was so very kind of you to remember all those things. I always feel like I've got the Parliamentarian of the Year for this and for that. And I keep thinking, where's Miss Congeniality? One of these days, I'll finally crack it. But it's Maclean's magazine that hosts Parliamentarian of the Year awards. And those are the ones, you're quite right, they mean the most to me because it's based on votes from my colleagues in Parliament. And you're right. I mean, I now have, there's definitely Mike Morris from Kitchener Centre is the other Green MP, but that's it. There's, you know, you're not going to win any new titles with two votes. So it means a lot to me that my colleagues have given me those kinds of recognition, but it's also important that I give them recognition and that we move things forward in as nonpartisan a way as possible because politics has become more partisan and more unpleasant in recent years. And I think that where we can find a place where we can agree and work from there, that's always a good thing. So I also want to say on the record that one of the reasons that our platform in 2015 and 2019 was strong on intergenerational issues is that we develop our platform through our shadow cabinet, which is really great experts who are volunteers with the Green Party. We'd also have to say we rely a lot on Jen Squeeze research. We rely a lot on your website because you come up with, Jen Squeeze does, really creative, innovative policy solutions to the problem. So I would think, I mean, I'd mention in terms of Jen Squeeze that at 68 years old, I'm the oldest of the six people running for leadership in the Green Party. And my partner in this effort running as to take the party to co-leadership is the youngest. Jonathan Pedno is 32. And our current interim leader, Dr. Amita Kuttner, he's even younger than Jonathan. We really believe we have real engagement with youth. And in a real way, especially around the climate crisis, which I'm sure we'll touch on, but you mentioned, of course, the housing and wealth creation and the lack of policies that advance. I mean, the gig economy is so brutal for young people. I'm just overwhelmed by how unfair our society is towards young people, and I'm really unhappy, as I know you are, with the failure of larger political parties to take up a championship role for intergenerational fairness. But I am at 68, as I've mentioned. I'm an older, crankier version of Greta Thunberg. I'm really angry. And Jonathan Pedno is a genius, former journalist, documentary filmmaker, and someone who's devoted his life to human rights issues and largely working in conflict zones around the world. Like, where the two of us are really a good duo, I think, to take on the next phase of rebuilding the Green Party, being ready for elections and all that. But I was honored to be one of the first to sign up to the pledge. Happy to chat with you about all that. Just responding to that very generous introduction, we are serious about speaking up for and defending the younger generation that in this country, I mean, so many, and it's because of voting patterns. We all know this, right? If you're looking at who votes, people my age are much more likely to vote than people Jonathan's age or even younger. We've got to really address the fact that so many decisions are made about the future of the younger generation without their buy-in, because that there's a low voter turnout among younger people, which is something that we have to address. And of course, the lack of fairness in our voting system is another whole question. But I'll leave it for there and just say I'm really grateful for your work, Professor Kershaw. And I'm grateful that you created Jen Squeeze, because it does give people in political life a go-to for research and data and policy solutions that are very creative.
Well, now I'm blushing, and people can't even tell that on a podcast episode. You've raised a range of issues, and let me talk about your collaboration with Jonathan. You touched on that, and I think it's so intriguing. I perceive you to be actually running an intergenerational ticket in this campaign for leadership of the Green Party of Canada right now. And I suspect there's the co-leadership model partly reflects it, as you identified you're 68. And I think, you know, a couple of years ago, you were intending to kind of step back a little bit and potentially, you know, many people start thinking about retirement and whatnot. But I think that the co-leadership model actually likely reflects this commitment to intergenerational solidarity that has been at the heart of so much of your work as a movement leader over the last many decades. Am I right in perceiving that? And tell me a little bit more about the logic that's drawn the two of you together.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's something that's a co-leadership model is very common in the global green family of green parties. There are 80 green parties at the national level around the world. 11 of them are now in cabinets, in governments, whether Germany, New Zealand, Scotland, there's Luxembourg, there's 11 countries right now, Ireland, with Green Party leaders serving in cabinets with other parties, and of course, all in countries that have fair voting and proportional representation. But they're not always intergenerational to this extent, but it's really a deliberate effort. I did step back because, speaking of intergenerational, I promised my daughter going into the 2019 campaign, I'd actually made an earlier promise. Okay, I won't. 2015 will be the last time I lead the party into a national campaign. And then there were just issues with trying to figure out who's ready. Is the party ready? Is this a good time for me to step down? So I promised my daughter I'll step down after the 2019 campaign. And as you can imagine, the conversation when I decided I have to run for leader again, she said, "Mommy, yes, I know you kept your promise not to continue in 2019, but do you think you're still keeping your promise if you're running again in 2022? So this was a part of a larger conversation. I was, I won't get into all the details of my incredibly blessed relationship with my daughter, but I was a single mom for virtually all her life. And when I made the promise that now I'm married and my husband's very keen on there's no reason to retire. The work isn't done, right? So, but I also knew that the job I had held as leader of the party from 2006 to 2019 was within a flawed structure. And I'm co-chair of something called the Global Greens Parliamentarians Association. And so most of those Greens around the world who are leaders of their own parties are friends of mine, either directly all the time in person or occasionally just email friends. But in consulting with them, I really felt that the Green Party of Canada would benefit from this distributed leadership model of co-leadership, which, as I said, is probably about 30 of the global green parties around the world are now in a co-leader model. There's only one party in Canada that already has co-leaders, and that's Quebec Solidaire. So people in the, as we say, the ROC, rest of Canada outside Quebec, don't necessarily know that we have a prominent and in the last election growing political party, and they also do have their co-leaders are also representing different generations. But Jonathan Pagnot and I got to be friends because he was beginning to research and prod a bit to the idea that he was going to run for leader of the Green Party of Canada. And I put to him, after we got to know each other, "Would you consider running with me?" I had talked to a number of Global Green colleagues. My friend Carolyn Lucas, who's the current Member of Parliament for Brighton Pavilion in the Parliament of Westminster in London, and she's brilliant, and she has had a very quite similar career path to me in that she became a Member of Parliament when she was leader of her party. She was the first Green anywhere in the world in the perverse first past the post voting system to get elected. She was elected in 2010, then I was elected in 2011. She stepped down the minute she won as a Member of Parliament for Brighton Pavilion. She stepped down as leader because she didn't think she could do both things at the same time. I foolishly thought I could do both things at the same time because I didn't have any kids at home and I was single. She had married, had kids at home, so she stepped down. It didn't go so well, and she came back as leader, but she came back with a much younger colleague, changing the party to co-leadership. And it is very deliberate. And when I talked to Carolyn, she said, "See if you can find someone with whom you know you can work and you really can trust entirely, you're really putting your life in their hands, but who's much younger." So you're quite right. In the case of Jonathan and me, and there's some other very good candidates running for co-leadership this time around, Chad Walcott and Anna Keenan, but they don't have a big age gap thing. Jonathan Pagnot and I are deliberate in saying this is a younger generation that has every reason to be angry, and they have every reason to be angry, at the boomers, my generation, and my and what I've increasingly started to say to young people, and I decided I had to run for leader again because of realizing that we are running out of time on the climate crisis. The IPCC report from April 4th of this year shook me badly because I knew we didn't have much time. But I thought we had more time than the IPCC informed us in April, which was to say, we, in order to hold on to 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees C, globally, emissions must peak and fall between 2020 and at the latest, that's the language used, at the latest before 2025. And I'm looking across the aisle and thinking, the Liberals and the NDP have just done a deal that says we're not going to go into another election till 2025, which means the window closes on a livable world before the next election. And I'm not making a big enough difference at all as one MP among 338, not the party leader, party parliamentary leader, whatever, the national media is not interested in what green MPs have to say. And they're not much interested in what the leader of the party, there have been three leaders since I stepped down in 2019. They don't get the media attention because they're not in the House. So the combination of if we're going to make a difference and really punish the Liberals for multiple betrayals and wonderful lofty language on climate, followed by incrementalism and hypocrisy. You don't say we're climate leaders and Justin Trudeau saying in Paris, Canada is back. And then we not only approved the Kinder Morgan pipeline, bought the pipeline, now it's a crown corporation. Well, I felt that this role for a boomer is essential. We should not be, my generation must not be let off the hook by your generation or younger people, because we're responsible for this. As far as I'm concerned, I'm deliberately reaching out to radicalized grandparents.
Let me pick up on that because I think your tactics for promoting the concept of generational fairness over your career has evolving, and your language right now about, you know, being a boomer, talking, to use our language, hard truths to other boomers, is, I think, a really important moment. You know, there have been times when, as I've invited boomers to reflect on some of parts of their legacy that, you know, the data don't suggest we can be as proud about as they might like, that can sometimes create tension and people often, even sometimes, like, oh, you're boomer bashing. By contrast, when a member of the generational cohort actually invites other boomers to say, what are we leaving? I think that's really powerful. So what about your career has motivated you to be willing to have that hard conversation with members of your generation over the last many years?
I think I've had a very unusual life in that I was raised to be an activist. My mother was an activist. It's very strange right now that Thomas Homer Dixon, who's a best-selling author and academic, his book that came out during COVID called Commanding Hope, strangely enough, is about my mother. This is strange because my mother was, until Thomas Homer Dixon started writing about her, definitely an unknown activist. And Tad Homer Dixon said to me at one point when he was working on research for the book, he said, you know, Elizabeth, if your mom had been a man, she'd be famous. Because her issue was ending nuclear weapons testing, and she was a grassroots organizer and activist, and she made a big difference. But I was raised to be an activist, which means the hard truths are the only ones worth talking about. You don't get away with saying, and oh, gosh, I've been so sick of it. When I stepped down as leader, people wanted to know what I thought my legacy was. I said, legacy? I've been nothing but a failure. I've been working on climate since 1987. And in that time, we've emitted more greenhouse gases globally from then till now, as between the beginning of the Industrialized Revolution and the Rio Earth Summit in 92. Our generation cannot just say, oh, I did a good job. I helped raise. I mean, people try to tell me that I've accomplished something, and I say, absolutely not. We have, and it's a kind of pledge. It's very hard to keep. I refuse to die till this is fixed. I'm not going to let my grandchildren.
That's a harder pledge than ours.
Well, it is hard, but the idea that I would retire or that there's lots of there's no time. And I also find that I'm not alone in this. A lot of a lot of my cohort know that our generation has stolen. I mean, this is Greta Thunberg's language, but we are conscious. Well, if we're not conscious of it, we're in denial. We are stealing our children and grandchildren's future because what? We're too lazy. It's too awkward. It's too hard to say to the other parties, you know, net zero by 2050 isn't a target. It without rapid, urgent, transformational change, it's an epitaph.
Mm-hmm. What we can commiserate is then people who share publicly that we, you know, we fear we're failures at the movements we're trying to lead. It's something I've been more on the record saying these days. And it has me wondering about, you know, the urgency of the stress. It has me wondering about how you're talking. It's so urgent. We have so little time left. And I've been trying to have people recognize, you know, the same systemic pattern that has generations today and older generations that have come before us, like, extract so much of the atmosphere's scarce capacity to absorb carbon that we're leaving extreme weather as a legacy. It's the same pattern where we're extracting so much wealth from our housing system and leaving unaffordability left over, or we're utilizing tax dollars disproportionately for, like, later in our life course for an aging population that we love and adore and want to protect as it ages, but then underinvesting in the childcare or the post-secondary or some of the income supports for younger people. And then all in all, then leaving, despite that underinvestment, leaving large debts fiscally and environmentally for younger people to take on. And so I haven't been as effective at having people connect those dots, and I feel the urgency. And when I think about that urgency and I see somebody like you leading a movement talking about urgency, I'm curious about, like, what's your theory of change right now? If I reflect on sort of perhaps past theories of change you've likely had as a movement leader, is like, I'm going to run for political office. Politics responds to those who organize and show up. So I'm going to organize in the world of politics, have a banner of, you know, the Green Party candidates run underneath this, and we're going to use that. And I imagine partly you thought you were going to change the electoral system, because it's a hard mountain to climb in a first-past-the-post system, your approach. And of course, we've run into barriers on that front, and then Prime Minister Trudeau did not live up to his election promise to do away with first-past-the-post, which is a barrier to some of the changes we likely need to make. But if I look, like, what's your strategy given that context? I do think I see you were critical about the pace at which the NDP and the Liberals are adapting, but I see in the 2019 and in the 2021 elections evidence that more and more those parties are taking Green Party ideas.
Oh yeah, they take our ideas.
So is that your strategy to influence the other parties, or am I missing? What's your current strategy right now as you return and you say there's urgency in the next elections after the window of 2025? So what's driving that? Help me understand that strategy a bit more.
Well, the strategy, I guess my theory of change, and because I didn't get involved in politics till I was 52, so it's a generational thing. What I was doing for most of my life was environmental advocacy with the theory of change that you organize, you mobilize, you lobby, you get media coverage, and you let politicians know and decision makers know that there's a certain amount of pain that they will experience if they ignore the demands that you're making, and that there's also a willingness to say credit where credit's due. We will celebrate you if you do the right thing. And I got involved in the Green Party at the point that, I mean, this was not to get into all the details, but back in, I decided to leave the Sierra Club of Canada, where I'd been executive director for 17 years doing grassroots local organizing mostly, as well as sophisticated campaigns at the national level. But I decided to become to run for leader of the Green Party, which meant leaving my nonpartisan work at Sierra Club, because I saw Stephen Harper as the first politician I'd ever encountered, and I knew him pretty well then, who actively disliked the environment as an issue. A real hostility to climate action. So now, as you say, all the parties talk about climate. So is that a success? Well, back to the title of this podcast, Hard Truth. The hard truth is that the difference between the Liberals and the NDP with policies that sound really favorable to climate action, but which fail to meet the requirements of science, and the Conservatives, with, I won't bother categorizing what they do, but Bill McKibben, who of course is one of the leading climate advocates and best-selling authors, and Bill McKibben is just an extraordinary human being, but what as a climate activist, he said the difference between you know, nice words and inadequate action from Liberals and NDP and Conservatives is really that with the Liberals, we lose more slowly, but we're losing. And when we lose, this is what we don't get to talk about at all. So, I mean, in Parliament, there's the Liberal talking points are, we have a commitment to net zero by 2050. We're going to deliver on, without any recognition that the IPCC has made it very clear, any science tells you, that we have to dramatically reduce emissions in the short term and by roughly half by 2030. But again, the April 4th report saying global emissions must peak and begin to fall before 2025. I'm always searching for more accessible language. I'm basically saying we have to stop adding and start subtracting globally before 2025. That's doable, but not when people are celebrating the idea that they've somehow got it covered because we've adopted net zero by 2050. And in our heads, that turns into a 45 degree angle that just drops down slowly and steadily till 2050. And that sounds doable. But the curve is a sharp drop immediately, and then it flattens out towards 2050. So my theory of change is before 2025, the Liberals have to feel some pain. And I have to deliver that pain, although I'm a nice person and I'll never make it personal and I never do anything ad hominem. And I love my colleagues in Parliament, but I have to say the truth to their face out loud. And sometimes I have to say shame. Shame on the minister. Shame on the prime minister. And I also have to hope that some MPs who are feeling that way themselves will cross the floor and sit with us. How do we deliver pain before 2025? More MPs have to sit as Greens. We have to win some by-elections before the next federal election so that when they're designing their platforms up till 2025, number one, my clear goal is to shut down the Trans Mountain Pipeline. We own it. It's a crown corporation that's costing us billions. I sometimes think we need math lessons. What is a billion? It's 1,000 million. Like, what are we doing? Are we insane that we would put $21 billion into a pipeline that violates indigenous rights, that threatens our coastlines with tanker spills, that's up, you know, we allowed Crown Corporation, TMX, to be running, I'm sure you notice this being in Vancouver, to be in the Coquihalla River and actually threatening a live salmon run with heavy equipment in the river to build the damn pipeline, and we own it? So we have to shut down the Trans Mountain Pipeline. We have to cancel Bay du Nord, the drilling off the coast of Newfoundland, and we have to ban fracking. If we do those three things, Canada's overall climate record will cease being the worst of the industrialized world and at least become congruent with the advice we're getting from the IPCC. But to continue to say we can do both is as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said, this is moral and economic madness.
Pathway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator.
Yes.
I think is the most recent quote.
That's what he said this week at the opening of COP27.
Can I take you back to your observations about how you plan to execute that theory of change in the House? And you talk about telling hard truths. I think you even, like, at certain moments, expressing shame. But there's a tone that you commit to doing it with. And I at Jen Squeeze, like, one part of our theory of change that we need to be in the business of renewing democracy, that, like, individuals can't work ourselves out of these systemic problems alone. We need politics to work. So we have to help people resist the cynicism that they often feel about politics and resist the anger that we often are bringing into politics in ways that can be not constructive. And so that we can, like, create a kind of solidarity across generations and at certain moments, even between parties. And I wonder, I think I interpret your latest offer to serve as a co-leader of the Green Party is partly wanting to bring some of that tone. I mean, I heard you talk about wanting to bring pain and shame, but my sense is there's a civility that you aim to bring, and I'm attracted to that. And so I want to ask you about this in a really specific way. One thing I took hope from in the 2021 election was that all the big parties at that time, even if only just rhetorically, did embrace the green logic that we need to price pollution. I think Mr. O'Toole, then leader of the Conservative Party, deserves credit for that. which makes me then worried, and I'm actually writing about that in an upcoming column in The Globe, that I'm worried that Mr. Polyev has backed away from that commitment. It's actually trying to court votes in his campaign to become prime minister by promising to axe the price on pollution. And so, given what you just described, and, you know, and I know you have a track record of working across parties, like what tactics, if any, do you anticipate using to try and encourage a Mr. Polyev to retreat from his party's retreat in embracing pricing pollution? Do you even think it's possible to have him reverse course? Because it seems so critical, if we're going to make urgent action by 2025, that we have all parties at least agreeing on it's important to price pollution.
We really need to figure out the, number one, as I said, I'm very focused on what happens before the next election. And again, back to co-leadership, Jonathan Pagno and I are job sharing. That's another Jen Squeeze notion, right? So, we've got a job share, and he'll be doing a lot of the work on the outside while I'm trying to do this work inside Parliament.
I hope Jonathan gets a decent pension on his part of the gig economy.
Well, yeah, there's a thought. The next election, I think it's really important that we have a lot of healing to do in society. So taking it beyond the partisanship, we really have never had a time where a significant chunk of Canadians are prepared to believe things that simply aren't so. But we can't demonize that segment of our population. We can't say, if you didn't get vaccinated because you think ivermectin was going to work, and I'm members of my family. I'm going to say, Paul, this has been very devastating for so many Canadians. We have to figure out a way, in terms of civility, to restore that old Canadian aphorism that we can disagree without being disagreeable. We are losing that because of the Trumpian nature of political discourse, which is contaminating Canada too. So where we're at right now is I want to be back in that as a voice in the public square for Canada, so that other grown-ups feel as though speaking, and I'm not saying that in the younger generation, or in this, the mature voices of someone like Jonathan Pagno is far more grown-up than Pierre Poilievre, but we need to have a space of respect and sharing and healing so that we can work together as a society the way I think we were more able to do before COVID. And we need to get activists and thoughtful progressives, however described, and climate activists to recognize, don't freak out about Pierre Poilievre and decide that forces you to strategic vote for the Liberals. Don't do that. Think about the parliament we want is a parliament with many smaller parties with a commitment to work together to have a coalition or whatever, confidence and supply agreement. Because as long as the perversity of first past the post has actually prevented the Conservatives from forming government for the last two elections. Strangely enough, they won the popular vote. They had more votes than Liberals, but no one had a majority. In that context, we need more Greens than ever, because we'll be in a position to say we're not forming any kind of an agreement with Liberals, NDP, and Bloc to prevent Pierre Poilievre from becoming prime minister, unless he decides to change all his policies. But let's just look at it and say, what is the smart vote in 2025? I know we're going to face, we always do, this massive tsunami of, if you don't vote Liberal, you're going to get Pierre Poilievre. Well, how about if we vote smart and elect smart people who are going to say, we want intergenerational fairness. We will not support any government that's pursuing increased greenhouse gases from this country when we must be pulling our fair share of the load. And frankly, our record is so much worse than even the United States. People, Canadians often don't know that. And we want to see fairness in our voting system. And unless we get those two things, we're not going to share in making sure that we prop up a Liberal or an NDP government. And I think it's more likely to be that the Liberals are in a position again, but only if they have Green support, NDP support, Bloc support even, to create a different kind of sharing consensus-based government. That is, so my theory of change is, before the next election, I don't want to go into the next election, and as co-leaders, it may be Jonathan Pagnot who takes the lead and does the leaders' debates and so on, and not me. But I don't want to go into the 2025 election where Mike Morris and I have the best record of any two hardworking MPs you'll ever have seen. No, I want to go into the next election that Greens already have a far expanded caucus, and people are back to taking us seriously.
Well, let me pick up on one observation you made about the possibility of electing people who, you know, pledge to champion the idea of generational fairness, because you'll know that'll make my heart go pitter-patter very quickly. But our Gen Fairness Champions pledge asks political leaders to invest fairly in young and old alike, prioritize housing for homes first, investment second, invest more in preventing illness and not just waiting to treat illness after the fact, reduce government debts, and then to leave the planet better than we found it. And clearly, your record on the latter is as strong as any person in Canada that I can think of. And I wonder if on the other issues I might be, just take a moment to push you a little bit. So for instance, when I review the Green Party of Canada platforms in the past, I've never once seen a Green Party say, we are going to pledge that all future federal budgets are going to break down how the spending plays out by age, so that our parliamentarians actually know that something like old age security is growing so much more quickly. Even when we make historic investments in childcare, old age security is so much faster than that. Not that old age security is a problem, but I don't think most parliamentarians even know. And I also wonder about, you know, you're relatively strong, your party, on investing in preventing illness rather than just treating it. And you have your investments in social determinants, like whether your work on childcare or your work on a guaranteed income or your work on reducing tuition for students.
Eliminating tuition.
These are all things that would improve the conditions into which young people are born, grow, live, work, and age. And you go and do important things like pharmacare, which is important for our aging population, or extended long-term care for the seniors that we love. On the latter issue, though, I've never seen the Green Party ask the following question. You do propose we need a comprehensive review of our tax system. But as we do, we need to ask, when we launch new programs that are targeted towards an older population, where we know we have this boomer bulge, that's the reality of being a baby boomer. You're a big group right now. And we're wanting to do new spending that during your lives in the as workers early on, you didn't have a chance to prepay into. How can we ask affluent members of that boomer demographic to say, oh, I'm going to be open to be paying a fair share of this additional medical care, this additional pharma care, this additional extended care for seniors, so that I don't leave unpaid bills for my kids and grandkids on top of the unpaid environmental deficits we're leaving them?
Well, I mean, you have seen in Green Party platforms the commitment to tax wealth. Income has a certain distorting effect.
Totally agree.
And so we are talking about that because we know we need additional resources and financial resources in order to be able to have a fair society. If we're going to, I mean, for instance, eliminating tuition. I mean, I'll look at how many countries in Europe have free tuition. And here we have this perversity of, I mean, at least they're removing the interest on student debts. There's a bit more of awareness of that. We are pressuring in terms of childcare, pharmacare, and so on. But you're quite right. I mean, we do need to see budgets broken down by age. Absolutely. Because I think a lot of Canadians aren't aware. And we do know that, you know, a 300% increase in house prices since the year 2000 is insane. I happen to be one of the boomers who hasn't been able to afford to have a house. So that's okay. This is out of my reach, too. But it's on a generational basis, it's very clearly unfair. You're generation and younger than you. I mean, I'm pretty blunt when I talk to university classes. You guys are screwed. And it's not fair. I'm sorry for being blunt. It's completely unfair. And what kind of grandparents are we that we think that's okay? Well, most people, when you put it to them, they say, no, that's not fair. But what are the solutions? So, and we have to separate out that, I mean, yes, we have great policies on the getting rid of the distortions in the housing market created by speculation and investment. But I don't know that we have all the right answers yet. This is
We can help you with that.
But yeah, I know. But I mean, this is one of the areas where I love going to the Gen Squeeze websites. But we also in the way the Green Party develops platform and policy. It's not up to the leader or leaders, or our policies are developed through our membership. The membership is really, I think, attuned to this question of intergenerational fairness. But again, that's another way of demonstrating it in real life is Jonathan Pedno and me as co-leaders. I think we can address intergenerational fairness much more directly if we're elected leaders. We don't get to dictate a platform, but we can work on it within the very grassroots democratic way that we typically come up. We had a bit of a glitch in the last election. It wasn't so grassroots and democratic in the same transparent way that we need to restore, because we really do, as Greens, it's in our constitution that decision making is by consensus. We do have a Young Greens entity that speaks to the role of youth in our own decision making as a party. And we also, it was one of my private members' bills in the last parliament that didn't succeed and is reducing the voting age to 16. But if you look across the country, the Green Party of BC has introduced it, the Green Party of New Brunswick, Green Party of Ontario, Green Party of PEI, and federally. We really want to see young people begin to be able to play a vital role in the decisions made in this country by age 16. But there's so much complexity to the question you've asked. We haven't done, I will say, you know, when you put it to me that you haven't seen a platform that speaks to that, that's a challenge. And we must do that, because we're looking at, yes, we certainly understand intergenerational unfairness in terms of the climate crisis, but the economic structure of our society and there's tremendous unfairness in terms of wealth distribution that on top of generational change. We also know that our society has become less and less equal, and we have more and more and more billionaires. This isn't something we want. I don't dislike billionaires. I'll try this out on your podcast. It's probably a bad idea, but I've been thinking lately, when people say, when you fly across the country, you can plant a tree. And I'm thinking, it doesn't really make up for the fact you just flew across the country and I have to do that for work. So in terms of, I think instead of planting a tree, we want to make a big difference, plant a billionaire. Head down. But the problem with that is, of course, that I'm a pacifist. But I do think we could really make a case that it's time to, they'll suffer as mere millionaires, but billionaires the growth in the number of billionaires in this country, the handful of families that own most of the wealth in Canada is shocking. So the inequity of intergenerational inequality, and within our society, the super wealthy and everybody else, the 1% and the 99%, it's not something that we thought we had in Canada until recently, and we certainly do. We have a celebration of wealth and conspicuous consumption that is immoral, and we have to call it out, and we have to restore equity and equality in many ways in our society. As you mentioned earlier, consciously and actively against racism, consciously and actively demanding land back and reconciliation. And in that context of seeking equality and fairness, intergenerational equality and fairness is central.
Well, as we wind down, well, there are just so many things that I'd love to carry on our conversation. So we'll have to do this again, Elizabeth. One, I want to push back, though. If you're telling younger people that we're screwed, I want to say, tell them we're squeezed. If we're screwed, there's so little hope. If they're squeezed, we can squeeze back.
Sorry.
We can turn the lemon into lemonade, and there remains hope. So that's why Jen Squeeze is branded as we are. So we are resisting the screwed possibility right now.
I'm sorry. I look at it and I think, how did we allow this to happen? And Jen Squeeze has opened my eyes to much of it. And I do have hope. And I don't believe for one minute that we are, if I didn't have hope, that would be a good time to go on vacation and decide to heck with it. I'm going to work harder than I've ever worked in my life, because we must. It is not acceptable that the boomer generation should stop working at the moment that we know that we've got enough time to make the difference to ensure that the younger generations, that our kids and grandkids, have a secure future in a fair society on a sustainable, healthy planet. We've got time to make that happen, but we don't have time if we just wring our hands. I finished a speech the other day. I'd never said this before, but I thought for people my age, said, stop wringing your hands, raise your fist. We've got to be more radical as elders who demand that we fix the unfairness, because I totally agree with you. Thanks for catching me up on it. Your generation is squeezed, not screwed. Ditto for my generation. We have an obligation to fix things now, immediately.
And I think as we ask people to jump in on that front, it is really critical to draw attention to the discrepancy between billionaires and the rest of us. But we have to be careful not to do that in a way that inclines many of us, like, well, I guess we're not relatively affluent, or that we don't have some ability to contribute more. Because I do worry sometimes we left many off in the 99% off the hook. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to say, no, it's up to all of us at this moment. And I really welcome the way in which you model that for us, MP Elizabeth May. I want to thank you for joining Jen Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast today. And thank you for the years of service on behalf of Canadians young and old alike, and especially future generations. I do wish you luck in the upcoming Green Party Canada Leadership Convention, for which the voting begins, I believe, on November 12th, and the results learned on November 19th.
Correct.
And listeners, as we wind up, please, 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 as always, share this episode widely with your friends and family, and invite them to subscribe to our Hard Truths podcast wherever they find their podcast. And don't just think it's an act of clicktivism that has little ability to fix big systemic problems. It's quite the opposite. Our power to influence policy change in Canada, our power to make Canada work for all generations, grows with the size of our network. Until next time, cheers.
Thank you. Continued good luck. Thank you, Jen Squeeze. And thank you, Paul.